Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Dug Too Deep, the officially unofficial podcast for the Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 4, titled The Great Wave, which I have some thoughts on. I have some thoughts on what The Great Wave might be. Maybe we could talk about that later. But Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
I didn't think last episode was terrible. But I thought this was an improvement over last episode, mostly because if Galadriel is going to be this pig-headed, stubborn, and kind of like undiplomatic in how she treats her fellow sentient beings on Middle Earth, then she should get some blowback for it. And I thought her ass getting thrown in jail was about the cold bucket of water that her hot head needed. So I liked that there were some consequences on that. I still am kind of like unsure about what they're trying to do with Numenor, but I liked it. I liked it better this week. I thought that the dwarves in this show, the dwarves at the height of their empire, their mining techniques, they're pleading with the mountains to return their breathing, surviving collapse of mine. The relationship between Durin and Elrond, the Durin and his father. I think that stuff is excellent. And the stuff going on with Arendir in the Southlands looks like it's going to dovetail nicely into Galadriel here pretty soon. And I'm pretty intrigued by this evil Morgul blade that seems to be taking over this poor young man. If I know my Tolkien right, that's not... You never want... Like, even a seemingly nice magical artifact like a golden ring will fuck your shit up. This thing... looks like a vampire blade or whatever. So like I feel bad for this kid. What about you? How does a less Tolkien nerd, how did you find this episode?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in agreement with you. I think this is better than last episode. I still find the Galadriel stuff like the weaker parts of the episode, but not as weak as last episode. And mostly due to the fact that the show has acknowledged what I thought were the weaknesses of last episode. It's saying, yeah, her approach was stupid. And it's getting her nowhere. And Hallbrand like telling her, look, you've got to be a little more subtle when you're dealing with these political leaders. Cause they're not playing on the same battlefield. You know, I think that was all very good. And helped even salvage a little bit of last episode. And the dwarf stuff. Yeah. It continues to be my favorite part of the series so far. That and the Harfoots, who are absent from this episode. Overall, I really enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, I missed the Harfoots, but honestly, I got so much good dwarf action. Mm-hmm. They're dwarven helmets. Open up. I thought that was so cool. Their little face part of their dwarf helmets just wing, open up like little barn doors. Those helmets are so cool. I wish I had the money to cosplay as a dwarf for Halloween.
What would that even look like, man? You're a huge dwarf. You're a huge dwarf.
I'd have to use forced perspective in all the party shots and everything. But like,
even huger to play like Elrond.
I would just stand like 8 or 9 feet back from the camera and have all my like. But we'd stage it where it looks like I got my arms around my friends and all that. I mean, that might be a fun party gag. You'd have to get the Peter Jackson on the camera angles, but or maybe I'm just a big. Buddy the Elf. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just big for my. You know, I'm big for a dwarf. What are you going to do?
Yeah, that could work. I will say I'm a little. I'm cautiously, very cautiously optimistic about this because they're setting up things here in this episode that I'm not sure this show is equipped to properly give attention to.
The immigration policies of Numenor?
Yes. Dude,
when we get there, I want to
I've got some things to say myself.
Because I think the Great Wave is racism. I think the Great Wave is racism.
Oh, no. I thought the Great Wave was just division. Well, I mean,
metaphorically.
The plain reading is it's division that Muriel is afflicted with. But
what is the thing that is going to destroy Numenor? I think it's racism.
The rising tide of those goddamn immortal, hardworking, tireless, no sick policy needing elves.
Right.
They're going to take our employment away from us. Yeah.
And I don't know if the show has got the footwork necessary to dance through that minefield, but we'll see.
Sure.
We'll see.
Plus, it's just always problematic when you try to interpolate fantasy politics onto real world concerns, especially since, I don't know, I felt like they had rich canonical reasons for men and elves to be distrustful of each other, and they seem to be eschewing that with this more economic policy based. You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we'll talk. I'm sure we'll have a lot to say. They took her gerbs. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll have a lot to say when we get there.
Probably so. Anything else you want to say before we get into the recap?
Episode still is gorgeous, man. There's a couple scenes where I was just stricken by the beauty, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. The location, it's funny because we had people, will we ever get sick of the how beautiful everything is? And I haven't yet, but I will say that I think I've already started taking Numenor for granted.
Yep.
They do an establishing shot that pans through 180 degrees of some statue vomiting up this waterfall, it barely registers.
I know. It's a shame that happens, but it's definitely a phenomenon. I feel you. I'm looking at Harl? I have no idea what the dwarf city is.
Kazakh Doom. Or the Mines of Moria. Better known as the Mines of Moria.
Later on, yeah. They become all mines, no city. I don't know. I'm looking at that and I'm going, yeah, it's beautiful, but I've seen it already. And I've taken in its majesty. Is it going to continue to impress? Probably not, but it's still going to look great.
Yeah, and it's always nice to have good-looking locations versus bad-looking ones, so...
It's interesting, though.
And there's still lots of establishing shots, I'm sure, that they'll be able to drop our jaws with.
But now the challenge for them becomes not dropping your jaw for the first time, but not doing the opposite, not dropping the ball on that and making you go, well, that doesn't look as good as Numenor. That doesn't look as good as Har-Jaharl.
Yeah, Har-Jaharl. Then that's another thing we talked about in the feedback podcast, right? The fact that once they move away from the real life Middle Earth, New Zealand, are they still going to be able to do these jaw dropping vistas as easily and convincingly? And that remains to be seen because they're definitely, my God, setting such a high bar.
Yeah.
And the music, man, I got legit chills when Disa was singing through the mountains. The acoustics in my room, because the living room that I watch in, I got hardwood floors and I got a really nice sound system. And my God, that was sending shivers down my spine when she was firing up the pipes.
It might have shaken some of the mortar out of your bricks, too. Who knows?
Yeah, could have. It's kind of in the same way that the Blue Lady in Fifth Element is just kind of it's like so otherworldly and kind of like a focal point that you just kind of like, damn, you don't usually notice the stuff like that very often.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
All right, let's get into the recap. We start off with the Queen Regent, Mariel, dreaming of the destruction of Numenor by what I assume is the titular Grey Wave. And then she awakes.
Again, gorgeous scene. I like this ritual of the Queen welcoming in all the newborn babes of the month or whatever. And, you know, her being very regal and calming about this disaster. And then and the wave itself was fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, you know, we saw the scale of Numenor and this wave swallowing it all and seeing it destroy like the iconic white tree and all this stuff. I thought it was, you know, pretty incredible. It is, worthy of a Roland Emmerich type disaster movie. Yeah. You know,
sure.
Pull out and spare no expense to destroy an iconic location.
Mm-hmm. And you should notice in this scene, the petals falling. It's almost as important as the Great Wave, and it's a little more subtle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Iarion hears the builders that Halbrand beat up, sowing dissent amongst the people. Word of it spreads to the Chancellor. So he goes to the builders and tells them not to fear a single elf and swears that the elves will never take Numenor. It will remain a city of men. Then Kemen, I think, the Chancellor's son, introduces himself to Iarion, but he's interrupted.
Yeah, I don't know. This son is like, Pharazôn's interesting because he seems like a guy who is there to cool things off, but in a way that still stokes the fear. Mm-hmm. He's like, hey, settle down. Our forefathers were awesome, and we kind of like, it's kind of like we sometimes more jingoistic Americans will be like, oh, we saved France in WW2. Like, he's like, we bailed the elves' asses out and defeated Morgoth in the last war. And mm-hmm. so don't wait, you know, like how low have we stooped that we'd be afraid of one elf? But if there was anything to fear, you can trust that I am the guy who's going to keep Numenor an island for man and for man always, you know. So it's like, settle down, but not too much. And if there's ever a boiling situation, come look for me, Pharazôn, to sort it.
He absolutely seems like a political opportunist. I don't think he is necessarily an elf hater. I think he's just there for whatever the people seem to be swaying toward.
Yes, he's a politician. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, you're right. We do have a word for that sort of flim-flam artist. Yeah, we do.
He's got these guild badges. I was reminded of the art direction for... Do you remember, like, 15 years ago, the magic block was the Shards of Alara? And they had the Bant, which was like the white, blue, green shard. Like, all these guild badges remind me a lot of those sigils that they had. These, like, these gold coins are just all... And this guy is festooned with guild badges. How many guilds does he belong to?
He's collecting them like Boy Scout badges.
It looks like it looks like gold Boy Scout badges. And I liked, because a lot of people have noticed that the different cultures are putting idioms in to have something to do. You know, like the dwarves are always swearing by rocks, and the Harfoot are always talking about their feet and their wagon wheels and their caravans. I liked Farazone, like, swearing by the calluses of his hands.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, when is the last time he swung a hammer?
For sure.
How many of those badges does he really earn? Because he looks a little too regal to be chiseling stone.
Yeah, half of those are honorary, I'm sure. I don't know. So he's setting himself up here for failure. If you look at the episode in its entirety, the queen at the end of this episode decides to do directly the opposite of what he's promised the people, right? Like,
and he's
the
on
elves
board
are
for
giving
it.
Them commands, essentially.
Yeah.
And he supports that. I feel like next episode, or in the future sometime, he's going to have a real problem with the Builders Guild. Because if you also look at that audience of people who is volunteering, there's a lot of builders looking around at those people like, the fuck are these people doing? Volunteering to go help the elves over in Middle Earth. That's crazy. So I don't know if they're going to run with that or not, but that's the threat I see looming for him.
Well, and it's also convenient that we got Yarion, you know, the sister of Isildur and the daughter of Elendil is in that guild. So she'll be able to give us probably, you know, POV into that, whatever's going on there. We want to talk about the real life intersection of the politics here. I've got my little bugaboo. What are you worried about here?
I'm just worried that they're going to have the deft touch required for this. I don't see this as a show of like great nuance and fidelity. I see this as a sweeping epic, right? That is going to shortcut storylines in favor of getting through a lot of material and telling a much larger story. And that's what I'm worried about.
I'm worried that, like, anytime you blend fantasy things with an analogy to real life politics, you can run into trouble. And the one that kind of, like, when I was watching this, I'm like, this feels like a True Blood problem. Because True Blood, if you'll remember, is this, you know, campy vampire show on, I think, HBO. And it was loosely analogous to, like, people's views on vampirism was kind of like an analogy to what people thought about the LGBTQ rights, you know. You know, they called them fangers, and, you know, that they were hunting and trying to convert to their way of lifestyle. And it's like, it muddies the water, because, like, I don't think any fair-minded person should have a problem with the gay people or what they do. However, if a sizable portion of gay people were actively hunting me and trying to drink my blood and ripping my head off and perhaps converting me forcibly to their lifestyle by biting me and turning me into a vampire, there might need to be some extra legislation for superpowered beings that are fucking hunting another population down in sizable quantities. This tradespeople, when they're saying, these elves, they live forever, they never get sick, they never get tired, they're just fucking better than us. They're not lying. None of this is like prejudice. This is based on real, actual fears. Galadriel was ready to swim across the Atlantic fucking ocean. How are you going to compete with that? How are you going to compete with that? Maybe we want to put some fucking tariffs on their products. Maybe we want, you know what I'm saying? It's like, so like, I want to be like, well, these guys, fuck these guys. They're anti-immigrants. I'm not too long ago, my family immigrated this country. But, you know, all the things they're saying about us were a bunch of bullshit and lies. The elves are supermen. And it would be worrisome if they would come over and start competing for your job. So like, it's muddy. I don't know how I feel about it.
That imperfect analogy. Yeah, you can run into some trouble. I don't know. I don't know. For various reasons. Yeah, I'm worried about this plotline, but we'll see how
especially
they
since in the like
to me, the obvious friction is the genetic or the inheritance, that you've got the elves that live forever and the men that don't. That's like,
okay,
you know, that's unfair. That's literally not equal treatment. That is like, it feels like, you know, God is playing favorites with his children, and that can stoke a lot of jealousy and resentment. But it's like, sure, coming down to immigration policies, afraid that the elves, yeah, are just going to take over.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, it'll manifest in all kinds of weird ways. I mean, it's manifesting it as like jealousy toward the person who is endowed with the gifts that you are envious of is crazy to me. You should be, yeah, you should be angry at the people who gave them those gifts and didn't give you those gifts, you know, if, sure, anything.
Mad at God.
But that's not how they feel, right? They turn to the gods and claim, you know, claim them as their own, and then say like, hey, these elves suck. I don't know.
I also want to know, how does Farazone work? Because they're in the middle of just like a random city square, mm-hmm, where people have started like rabble rousing, and he shows up and he's like fucking Spuds McKenzie with the Swedish Bikini Team and Bud Light, except for it's all these serving girls and wine. He's like, after the end of his speech, he's like, everyone a drink on me. And these ladies just smoothly slide out with these gold platters of goblets of wine. And like, I'm like, where? What, yeah, what,
the choreography,
what happened
there
here?
Is exceptional. But yeah,
the Coors Light silver bullet just pulled in. And, you know, like, what the hell?
I assumed they, and maybe this is me just judging the builders, but I assume they were right outside the pub is where they were like gathered talking.
Or is this like their guild hall or like their union, you know, UAW?
Which might double as the pub. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. It is. But I didn't, I just thought they were standing out in the middle of the streets.
Yeah. I gotcha. I don't know. Maybe he does have a wine tourage.
What do you think about the relationship between Farazone's son? I didn't catch his name.
Kemen, I think.
Kemen? Okay. What did you think, yeah, of... It's because there's all... The big theme in this episode was relationships of fathers and sons. And it looked like Farazone maybe thinks his son is not ready or doesn't take him serious or...
Mm.
You think,
I read that...
Did you get any of that?
I read that more as the continuing education of a son. I think, you know what? I was very impressed with the way that Kemen handled his father criticizing the way he speaks and the way he thinks.
All right.
He didn't seem to bristle at it. He just seemed to learn from it or take it in and move on. And I thought that impressed me. So I actually ended up through that sort of liking Kemen in a weird way. And I thought, you know, I didn't have any ill will toward Farazone in that moment either.
I thought it was interesting because, like, when Arian shows up, he's kind of like the way he observed, like, oh, my father, there's not a cause he can't turn to his own or a favor he can't call. Like, and Arian's like, oh, that's something to be admired, right? And he's like, yeah, I guess. It's, I don't know, there's something.
All right.
There's some kind of discontent there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not manifesting in a whiny or like insubordinate way, which I appreciate, you know?
Right.
That,
yeah,
can go pretty wrong pretty fast with the character, sure, if they let it get out of hand. But no, it was pretty good. Armenelos, that's a huge statue, right? Because they talk about how, like, are we not the people who raised Armenelos? Our mighty work or whatever. That's got to be that gigantic statue.
Isn't it the name of the city that they're in? Yeah, Armenelos is their capital city. So he's just talking about in general this beautiful city and all of its munificent works. Yeah,
gotcha. I wonder what that giant statue's name is.
That's probably Elros, their founder.
Oh,
the,
yeah,
you know, the half elven brother of Elrond.
Makes sense. All right, let's go over to Galadriel taking what she found in the Halls of Lore to Muriel and trying to convince her to give her and Hallbrand an army to fight Sauron in the Southlands. She's denied, so she threatens to take it to Muriel's father, and Muriel has her thrown in a cell.
It's funny because, like, I had just about gotten fed up with Galadriel when I was going through my first watch, and I was, like, literally kind of shouting at the screen,
queen regent or no, you can't talk to a nation's ruler like this. Like, what the? And then they just smash cut to her being in jail for sedition. And I'm like, okay, fine. Yeah. As long as the show's going to
nature, and I will not be denied by you or anyone. Slam.
Right, yeah, there's a tempest in me that will not be quelled by you, Queen Regent. And it's like very similar to Gandalf coming up to Denethor and being like, it's not granted to you the authority to deny the return of the king, Stuart. And he kind of put him in his place. But she actually got thrown her ass in jail. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
And also, like, that's also like, she's like, man, she's like, she starts off with like, well, I'm putting Numenor on a different path. Well, not all of Numenor stands against you. Like, oh my God, you're going to foment a rebellion and tell her this and then try to one up her with her goddamn father? Crazy Galadriel.
It was.
It's like 6,000 years old. Come on now.
Yeah. And Hallbrand's going to point her in the right direction here in a bit. Which I appreciate. All right, let's go over to Isildur continuing his training. He intentionally lets a rope slip and gets both himself and his two friends kicked out of the Sea Guard, and his friends are rightfully pissed off.
Yeah. He keeps on hearing this whisper of his name is Isildur from Numenor, but it's lit from behind, so it looks like I took it as like this is supposed to, you're supposed to look at this and see the shores of Valinor that Galadriel almost made it to in the first episode before she jumped off the but like what's confusing to me is, you know, as the Lorehounds talked about, is Numenor's not allowed to sail west. They're not like just thing that's not allowed by God for you to go to these sacred shores. And I've always thought the Elendil's house was like pretty faithful to the elves. They talked about him being an elf friend. And it's weird that it seems like that he wants to go west, which is to Valinor. And it's treated like a crackpot, something in a crackpot would do, not like this is forbidden. Like, you can't fucking do this. Like, nobody, everyone takes it like he's just being an idiot, not... like, you literally are going to be destroyed if you try this shit. And it's, I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's the national treasure of it all. Like I said, I don't know. They mentioned, you know, they had a crazy uncle or something, right? That tried this once before.
It's his brother, who's supposed to be his younger brother. That's the other thing. It's like, I'm very confused by what's seemingly are minor changes in canon, because Anarion is supposed to be Isildur's younger brother, but every time people talk about it, it's the older brother, and that's fine. Like, I don't care. I'm just confused because, like, why would you change that? You know, just Isildur has the better name recognition because he's got like two scenes in Lord of the Rings where Anarion literally has none, but. I don't, and like I said, the you know, saying that, like, I got to sail west to the real Numenor. I don't know where they're going with that.
I always kind of, so, you know, having just learned about this like three episodes ago, I view Numenor as sort of sealed up a lot like the Sublime in Westworld, to where like, if it's not opened to you, you can't enter it. It's just not physically possible. I don't care how far west you sail, you're going to either fall off the map or wrap back around or something.
So that's interesting, because I don't know if you remember, because that was one of the things I was kind of scratching my head in the first episode, is that I thought at this point in time there wasn't a physical barrier between Numenor and Valinor. It's just that it's kind of like it's not allowed the way that God didn't allow Adam and Eve to eat of the tree of the forbidden knowledge. Or knowledge of good and bad, right? Yeah. He's like, it's kind of like later they'll add a sword or two angels with a flaming sword and you just can't do it no more. But it seemed like it was like a metaphysical, like a spiritual portal opening, as well as just a distance that you sail. And I thought that was confusing.
It disappears after Galadriel jumps off the boat, right? It's gone.
It does. Yeah. No. I am perplexed. These are, to my mind, pretty serious changes in the canon, and I'm not upset about it. I just don't know. It's a disservicing me because
I am expecting to go this way and it's going another way. And there's no clear reason for me like, they're doing this because of the adaptation of this. And I'm just kind of confused.
Maybe if you're a big enough elf lover and with good enough prosthetic elf ears, you could find your way into Valinor. I don't know. But it's worth a shot.
I feel like Elrond could give about half of his ear away and still be a full-fledged elf. He's got bordering on donkey ears. I want to talk about that.
Okay. Whereas Adar probably needs another half inch or so.
Adar could use, like Adar, and maybe it's like a different racial component of the elves that get the ear size. But like, I would say the Galadriel and Arendir have what I would consider normal elf ears, and then you've got Celebrimbor and Elrond just fucking looking like goat people, borderline goat people. Very Tumas, Mr. Tumas from Lion, Witch, and a Wardrobe.
Okay. Not familiar, but I'll look that up.
That's other Christian allegory that these guys came up with.
All right, let's go over to Arendir meeting Adar, who turns out to be what I'm going to label as poor man's Lee Pace, right? Like,
my note says Family Dollar Lee Pace, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly... Any villain who isn't Lee Pace at this point isn't much of a villain in my mind. You need the stature, you need the physicality, but you need the intensity. And I feel like this guy got halfway to the intensity and the stature that I really wanted.
No, he's no Lee Pace. And, you know, he'd be improved if he was, but I'm not going to hold that against a guy. I think he did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. He really made a meal of that mercy killing of that orc. Like, his eyebrows and cheekbones. I've never seen a man's cheekbones quiver, but his cheekbones are quivering at the grief or the rage or whatever that he was feeling.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he's a bit of a shapeshifter too. I don't know. But yeah, he mercy kills an orc and then he sends Arendir to the Elven Tower to deliver Bronwyn's people a message.
Yes, he does. That's exactly what he does.
I was trying to decipher, speaking of his ear shape, I was trying to decipher, is he some kind of half elf? Is he a different type of elf? Because his ears are kind of pointy, but not like you said, Elrond pointy.
They might be trying to establish a difference between because like there are various different elves and they're, you know, if you listen to Lorehound's podcast, they're roughly divided on, you know, when the Valar invited them to Valinor, because the elves were woke up in Middle Earth and they're like, hey, what are you doing here, goofballs? You should come to Valinor with us. A lot of elves immediately said, yeah, dope, let's go. Some elves like, you know what? We actually like it over here in the twilight of Middle Earth. Some wanted to go and they stopped because they couldn't make it over to mountains. And there's like all, and those all became the different like main branches of elf people. And they might be with these ear shapes and sizes and stuff, trying to give like a way to distinguish those types of elves. But I don't understand, because I've seen, you know, Hugo Weaving in Lord of the Rings and he doesn't look like Mr. Tumas. So,
some of these.
And I thought that I also like, cause Galadriel has very understated ears too. I think they're perfect elf ears.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if she had giant donkey ears, how would she hide them under her hair in Numenor? Right.
Yeah. But what I was getting at is I'm pretty sure that her and Elrond are from the same kind of broadly speaking house. I could be wrong. But I thought they were all of the kind of the high elf type.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You know, all this elf ear talk has gotten me wondering, like, okay, is there a half elf? You know, do humans have sex with elves and produce offsprings? And then I was wondering, has there ever been a half orc? Do people ever have sex with orcs, produce offspring?
I think that was one of the speculation for where the Uruk-hai came from, that they had bred orc with man. That was one of the, films, Saruman's kind of like cooking them up like mushrooms down in his cellars. But I thought that there was some kind of twisted experiment of crossing elf orc with, does that sound like we talk? Cause I always thought when I was a kid reading that stuff, that's the first thing I'm like, geez, some dude had to fuck an orc. Or even worse, some lady got fucked by an orc. But, you know, or maybe some elf. I don't know.
Not my preference, but somebody's probably into that.
Yeah, there's some monster fuckers out there. Let it be known.
But
She-Hulk's exposing a lot of them.
Oh, but, really? Okay.
Yeah, green skin giantess. I mean, she's kind of orc. You give her some pointy teeth.
Is there a big horny crowd
there
out there for She-Hulk right now?
Duh. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Look, I said there's a bunch of monster fuckers out there.
Just asking the questions. Anyway, this scene is to tell us that Adar is trying to become a god, right? He's trying to become Sauron, I think.
Yeah, I'm not one yet. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Would Sauron say that, though? Because Sauron, even if his power ebbs and flows, but he's still he's never not a demigod. So I wondered if Sauron would say something like that.
Gotcha.
Or is this guy hoping to channel Sauron? Is he hoping to get that blade? Because it seems like that blade can confer very fast powers on people, according to the butcher bartender.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I wish that we got some more answers, because Arendir is here just trying to do his role as an investigative journalist, and Adar is just ignoring everything that he's saying.
He is, yeah.
Because he doesn't give a shit. They name checked this place called Beleriand. When we saw in the first episode, there that prologue of the episode, and they showed the War of Morgoth and how there was all these elves floating underwater. Apparently, Beleriand, I knew that it had sunk during this war, but I always assumed it was the size of California comparison to the United States. And I looked it up, and it's more of if the Rocky Mountains and everything west of it fell off of America.
Wow.
Is how big Beleriand was before it was submerged, and it's the sunken. And apparently both Adar and Arendir hail from this place. And it explains why these kind of watchwarden elves have a particular bug up their ass, because their entire homeland and the entire continent, right up to Lindor used to be an interior city, and now it's on the coast, has been destroyed by Morgoth and their forces. So damn, it goes a long way to explain their grudge here. And what all they lost, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the what used to be the Elven Tower. More people arrive from the human cities. They're running low on rations, so Theo volunteers to go into town and grab some. Bronwyn won't let him, but he and his friend go anyway. And they grab some food, but Theo wants to go search the tavern. So his friend just abandons him, and Theo's found by orcs, and he manages to hide.
He's going to be the finest interior orc fighter the humanity's got. He just, every episode, he gets ambushed in some kind of cabin or house by a wild orc.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Theo, man.
I don't like this friend. He seems like a real shit.
Well, I mean, Theo kind of told him to go on, right?
Yeah, but
it's nighttime and this is Orc Town. This is Orc Town.
Yeah, but come on. Are you the guy's friend or not? He seems like barely friends. He seems like he's friends with this kid because there's no other kids in town.
Yeah.
He's that are kind of close to his age. I don't know. We got a lot of rings of power to ponder. We'll be right back after this short break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday, covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
Did you think the Aes Tirith looked a little ruiny, a little bit more ruiny than you'd expect from a newly abandoned elf fortification? Like, it's crumbling, visibly crumbling. I figured that the elves would keep that shit up, you know?
Right.
Maybe the men moved in, this has gone to hell, you know? They just, like, a lot of wear and tear on that that tower.
It's hard to believe. I didn't really notice it.
I got really tickled at this show's idea of what it takes to feed the crowd that they're depicting.
A wheelbarrow full. Like
A wheelbarrow will keep you going for, I guess, infinity. Mm-hmm. Because like the one guy was dismissive about, oh, we don't even have, you know, that's not even enough for one. The five potatoes were not enough for one day's ration. Like, I think this wheelbarrow maybe will feed half of you. So,
yeah,
we'll
I
see.
Expected them to come back with just like carts with oxen drawn carts.
I thought they're going to steal a wagon or something that would like, OK, that'll give them a couple weeks, you know,
or an entire caravan and say, OK, we're good. We're done. We got all the supplies out of all the cities. But they come back with a wheelbarrow and a couple of sacks full of grain.
Yeah, Theo talks about like raiding this cellar, and they get to the building. It's a pretty big one. And I'm just like, man, you could get more shit out of my pantry, I think.
Right.
It's just not a lot of food. It's not a lot of food. And there's a lot of people to feed. But, you know, it's Hollywood. You just kind of squint and like, OK, sure.
I was also wondering about freshwater sources here. I assume the elves have built like wells into the tower. I'll just assume because it doesn't address the water concerns.
Yeah.
But that's fine. And then we go over to Durin, who has apparently decided to help build the tower. The king has okayed it. Celebrimbor says that he thinks Durin is hiding something, and Elrond goes to ask Deesa where her husband is, but she lies to him, claiming he's out on a mining expedition. And then afterward, Deesa meets Durin to tell him about Elrond's visit, and Elrond eavesdrops on the conversation and learns that they're doing something over in the old mine below Mirrormere. I did not realize elves had super hearing.
I think that's, I mean,
should I have known that?
I know in the Lord of the Rings they established that like Legolas could see way better. Like, you know, like Aragorn's always, what do your elf eyes see? And he's like, I see a flock of birds and it won't be here for another 5 minutes. Like,
is he lip-reading,
they got
maybe?
Super. Because super sight. Well, no, I was just saying that like if they can see that well, stands to reason all their senses are heightened. But also, I wondered if you were supposed to understand that he was reading lips too, because the way they do the extreme zoom and then onto his lips as he's kind of piecing out what they're saying, I was wondering. Mm-hmm. I think it's open to the interpretation.
Gotcha.
But
here's what I love about this whole conversation they have is. Uh-huh. I mean, Deesa's great. She's trying to cover here. She says, you know, he's gone to these old mines. Not old mines. He's gone on some mining expedition, and Elrond says it takes 2 days to get down there. And she's like, nah, it takes a couple hours if you're a dwarf. I want to see what a dwarf speed climbing looks like, because I lived with a rock climber for a while. Like a very talented rock climber. Mm-hmm. And he was very tall. He was like 6'5" or something ridiculous. And he had that to his advantage as a rock climber. And shorter people takes a lot more effort to cover the same ground that he could cover as a 6 foot five man. I want to see a 4 foot dwarf scaling a wall at speeds that could beat Legolas, at speeds that could beat Elrond. That's what I want to see, because it would look hilarious.
I think it's going to look like one of those climbing video games where you've got like God of War or Nathan Drake, where you can literally like leap up the mountain like 12 feet at a time. Just like, just jump handhold to handhold, drop 50 feet. Yeah, yeah. You're just like.
Gotcha. What I hope it would look like is a spider like skittering up just a sheer cliff.
That would be
fast motion, hands and feet.
Yeah, like those Mines of Moria orcs where they're climbing down a tower. Or sure. Climbing down all the pillars and whatnot. That would be cool. So everyone here is right. Like Celebrimbor is saying, Durin's hiding something from me. They're hiding Mithril. Mm-hmm. I think I wish the show would be a little bit more clear on some of these things, because it seems that, because you see in the background that the dwarves and the elves are building this huge tower that's going to hold this forge that's going to be as hot as a volcano and as pure as a star. Do you think the dwarves, certainly the dwarves don't know what Celebrimbor means to do with that tower, but do you even think that they know that it's going to be this giant smithing station? Because like, I feel it's funny that the elves are accusing the dwarves of hiding something for them when it seems clear that the elves are hiding something from the dwarves.
Yeah, the dwarves know it. Specifically Durin goes to Lindon at the end of this episode to figure out what they're hiding.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine like you'd build a tower and not ask, hey, what are you going to use this for? And whether you get a straight answer is another
towering
question, but right. Yeah. Flight of fancy, I just like towers.
Yeah. I thought that Disa looked incredible in that scene where her and Durin are standing on the bridge and are kind of being flirty. Her eyes, I don't know what they're doing from like a contact or CGI perspective, but they're like gold, like the metallic gold, and they're flashing and on this dark. And when they zoom out where you can see kind of Elrond's point of view, she does this like fierce 180 and her robes just kind of go swoosh around her and she stalks off. I'm like, fucking A. That, again, show's nailing the look of the stuff.
Absolutely. All right, Elrond decides to go to the old mine. He taps a rock, repeats a nursery rhyme, and discovers a secret chamber. And in that chamber, Durin catches him. And Elrond asks him, what's going on here? When Durin makes him promise that he won't repeat what he's about to tell him, and then shows him the new ore they discovered, Mithril. And Durin lets Elrond keep a piece, and then the mine caves in, and Durin charges in to help the miners.
Like a G. I love this about Durin, that like this thing's collapsing. He's got no hard hat. Mm-hmm. Without even thinking, he's like, there's four dwarves down there. And he just barrels in, wide stance, just chest thrust out. He's just going to go in there and wade in and save his dudes. I thought that was really endearing of him. And I also like this mountain, though. That felt real. And it made me think of, like, we talked about, Liv Tyler, Arwen's fate, and how she kind of, all the things Elrond said about her being alone and bereft and cold when she's going to finally die here in Middle Earth, all came true in the grand scope of history. Makes me think that Elrond's going to break his promise. Because I don't think Elrond comes across as a happy dude in Lord of the Rings. And certainly Arwen, his daughter, like she gets a measure of happiness by the end. But by the end of the epilogue of Lord of the Rings, she is bereft and alone and broken. So.
Yeah. And I think like the fact that he gets to keep a piece of this Mithril is the biggest tell here. I don't know if he'll intentionally break his oath here, but that piece might fall into the wrong hands or he leaves it out on a table or something. And Celebrimbor is like, well, what's that?
Yeah, that would be a real ball breaker if the gift that you give is friendship is the thing that, Celebrimbor is going through his pockets or something. Is like, what is this? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about what is this? Normally I can get through context clues, everything that the dwarves are up to. They mention the Disa found this new mineral or this new ore during a gold seaming. What is a gold seaming?
I think it's that, like, because you remember she said that the dwarf women's, their job is to kind of sing to the mountains and get it to vibrate in such a way, and you mm-hmm. are able to find the minerals. And my understanding that, like, ore comes in, like, seams of the rock. You always hear about hitting a vein or a seam of something. Yeah. And so they were, like, looking for gold and kind of, like, following that. And then they found this. Like, this is, like, a played-out gold mine. And they, in the deep, dark part of this old mine, they found this mystery metal.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense.
And also, just for fun, like myth, I thought it was interesting. They kind of make this point home that, like, this is called gray glitter in the dwarf tongue, mithril by Elvish. And if you know anything about Gandalf, one of his many side names, his aliases, is Mithrander. And you've got the same kind of myth, which means gray, because Mithrander means gray pilgrim or gray wanderer. So there's a neat, like, little Elvish root word thing here to enjoy as well.
Nice. All right, should we move over to Kemen running into Yarian again, literally this time?
Yeah,
he makes her a bet and the loser buys the other dinner. Classic move. I liked the little touch of Yarian sitting here just studying the architecture. You know, she's
right.
a new inductee into the Builders Guild, and she's all excited about it, and she's just out spending her free time looking at buildings and drawing them.
Seems like there's a lot of hazing that goes on with the Building Guild, because she's having to scrub floors and serve wine mm-hmm. more than she's allowed to just sit around and draw buildings and design things at this stage.
I mean, somebody's got to do it, right? The Guild Hall is not going to clean itself.
Why not the fucking new girl? Mm-hmm. They're the fucking new guys.
Mm-hmm. All right, then we go to the dungeon in Numenor, where Hall Brand advises Galadriel on how to approach the situation with Muriel. He says she should figure out what the queen fears and help her master it. And he helps her realize that her fear, the Muriel's, that is, has to do with her father. And then the Chancellor arrives, Farazan, and says that she's being shipped back to the elves tonight. She has her removed from her cell, but she's just, like, in Star Trek Picard fashion, turns the tables, locks the guards in her cell and heads off. And Halbrand's like, you know where she's headed. You maybe don't have to stop her. There was a little, that was a little silly. I don't know.
Yeah.
They don't show much of it, but it was just so easy how she got the upper hand.
Yeah, this is another thing, is like, I didn't think that elves outclassed Numenoreans this badly. Like, these are 4 to 6 strong, strapping Numenoreans in full armor and arms. Mm-hmm. And she is an elf woman in a flowy dress, no armor, no swords. And she just kind of, like, grabs them all and throws them in their own cell.
Yeah, and it's not
done, and it's just tidy. Yep. Very tidy.
It's not necessarily that I have a problem with. It's later in the episode where she's being put on a boat with 4 dudes who are rowing with, like, no swords out, no nothing. Like, if she wants to get off this boat, she can get off this boat.
Yeah, but I guess she was being meek about it. I would like to, maybe I have something to ask John, because this is something in the first episode. Remember, like, all of her elf special forces commandos mm-hmm. were getting destroyed by this ice troll, and then she just comes out and single-handedly handles it. Is she this that much more powerful than your average elf? And again, these Numenoreans are not like these fuckos in the south, or they're like got diluted mudblood or whatever kind of vaguely mm-hmm. weird stuff that we got going on here. They are like the real deal OG men, the men of fame, the men of glory, just like Farazona is talking about here. I don't know, maybe Galadriel's just that badass, but she handled these dudes.
Looking forward to her getting with Arendir later, not sexually, just hooking up with him. How do you say that without too. Sounding sexual, you know, meeting him later? Because holy shit, he has a badass move in this too.
He does. And I, the way she smirks at Farazone on her way out, like she's just she cannot not be this really abrasive person. She's like, yeah, I just if you're wanting to sell yourself as allies, I don't know if you just throw all the cops in jail if that's the way to get it done. But
right. Yeah. Let me ask you this. There was another line that was a little odd to me considering last week's episode. She says, you know, as Holbrand continues to make his metaphor here, comparing her to a horse, she says, "Cease comparing me to a horse." Mm-hmm. Doesn't she like really love and respect horses? I mean, she,
it seems,
I don't know, that shot last episode made me think she wouldn't mind being compared to a horse because they're majestic and amazing.
They are. Although I thought about it a little bit more, and that scene was as much about Galadriel has spent centuries doing nothing but miserable shit. And it's just like, fighting right. Yeah. It is actually kind of nice to gallop on a snow white stallion across a windswept seascape, right?
you know? That makes sense.
This is something actually pleasurable.
Anything else for this scene, or should we move on?
Let's move on.
All right. Yarian finds Isildur, who tells her what happened with the Sea Guard, and he feels pretty bad about it. But then he just gets he gets called off because the guards realize the elf has escaped and begin searching for her.
And again, and Arion says, "Oh, well, I guess we get to go west now." I'm like, "No, you won't." And he's like, "Well, I would, but my father won't let me bring Beric." And first of all, like, who the fuck is Beric? I don't know. I was talking to John just before the podcast, and he said that this Beric word has like a mannish root word of like wild. And he was speculating that maybe it's just like there is an aboriginal race of men that live somewhere, and then there might be like you know, a mirror of the way the elves are kind of coming at it mighty against the men that maybe they'll like come at against. But I feel like they already got that with the Southrons. I wonder if it's not
like one of their horses or something.
I wondered if it's a horse too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's the white one, the cheesy one.
Sure. Yeah. Grinning idiot of a horse.
But it's like there again, it's like I don't know that they've ever established the names, and they just show. I wonder if there's a bunch of stuff on the cutting room floor, because I just feel like there's a couple things at these edges where I don't think they've really established this Western. Do you know what the fuck he's talking about?
Not specifics. No, I just know he wants to go west, young man.
But like, why? What is west? Yeah. If I mean, it's the Holy Land, okay, fair enough. But why aren't people freaking out about it? And if it's not that, then what is it? I wish they were a little bit more clear about that and like who the hell Beric is and all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll find out more later, hopefully. I think it's ironic that, you know, he ends up going east instead of west, right? I don't know if that irony is more than just that or what. But
it's true. He's forgotten all about the west. He's going to Middle Earth, which will keep you out of the trouble with the gods, I suppose.
For sure. All right, Galadriel enters the King's Tower, where she finds him and Muriel waiting. She realizes that the king is very sick. She also asks Muriel why she's forsaken the elves. So Muriel takes her to the top of the tower and shows her a palantir, which is one of seven seeing stones. And Galadriel touches it and sees the great way of destroying Numenor. Then Muriel claims that that vision is punishment from the Valar for turning to darkness, which I think in her mind is them embracing the elves again. And Galadriel tries to use Halbrand's advice to turn her fear into friendship, but it doesn't work. I found this logic a little hard to follow. And I'm not sure that it doesn't make sense. I'm just trying to piece it all out. So Muriel thinks her father saw this vision. Knows that her father saw the vision, I think. And realizes that as soon as he did, as soon as he went through his coronation, he saw the vision and started talking about, we need to go back to the old ways with the elves where we were friends. And now that she sees the vision, she's trying to reverse what he did. But I don't know why she would do that if, like, her father saw the same vision and concluded that the path forward to avoid this curse from the Valar was to reunite with the elves.
It's not clear to me either. What I think they're getting at is the Numenor, for whatever reason, jealousy, trade war, retirement benefits, whatever, had been distancing themselves from the elves for, like, you know, for some time. And that her father got this vision and he's like, we have to reverse course. But since not everyone can go to the Palantir and see this vision, it's kind of like you just, and this got a lot of friction because Numenor is going in one direction culturally and politically. And then the leader is like, nope, we're 180 and going back the other way. Mm-hmm. And that I think that Muriel interprets the kingdom being torn apart by internal strife because she says the only Numenor can destroy Numenor. And that she thought that, like, what was causing the division of Numenor was them arguing about what they should do with the elves. And if she can just kind of, like, slow that down and maybe bend, like, dad's on the right path, but he's too radical.
Well, why would he?
But that is
a
lot
of
me surmising things.
Yeah, I don't know why he would see the same vision if he hasn't already set the path of the internal strife by returning to the old ways. Like, wouldn't they just be on the path of the gods?
Well, that's the other. So that's the other thing about the Palantir is, and they established this in Lord of the Rings too, is that, well, they established in this episode is that, like, you can't 100% rely on what it shows you because it shows you one of many paths.
Let me ask you, what good is a seeing stone that provides unreliable visions that may or may, it might as well be a pet rock.
Well, so, like, it's no. It's not that, like, it's an unreliable vision. It's like, unless you do something to correct the course. But that's I think. I did this because I was confused by this. I had a little bit of time to research this. Yeah. I read in some, there's some scholars in Tolkien that think the Palantir represent mankind trying to get some kind of surety about their future rather than putting faith in providence. And, you know, that's a fuddy-duddy word for essentially God's will. So, like, it's a sin to try to subvert God's will by trying to get a glimpse of the future and then trying to game plan. Because, like, you can imagine that, like, the reaction to the vision can set us, you know, this is a monkey's paw kind of thing, can, like, set to the, that can lead to the actually self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, that you bring about the conditions that cause the prophecy to occur. And then when you add people like Saruman and Sauron, perhaps very powerfully manipulating what you do and don't see through the Palantir so that you only see your worst fears, you never see your greatest hopes. That's another way it can be used to manipulate. And the other thing that I didn't understand is I thought the Numenors had seven Palantirs and they were all accounted for and they were all spread out later on through Gondor and Arnor, Arnor, the lands that the Numenorians will later go on to settle in Middle Earth. And that they only started going missing once Sauron started taking over, like, you know, Minas Morgul, that's the Witch King's hideout. Used to be, I think it's the Sildor's brothers Anarion's stronghold. It had every one of these, like, towers had a Palantir. The one at Orthanc, which was the tower that the Saruman was squatting in. And now they're saying, like, six have been lost or destroyed, and there's already only one. Yeah. But that tells me, like, I'm putting my Lord of the Rings hat and be like, well, who has the other ones? And how are the Numenorians being manipulated by these dark forces?
Gotcha. I guess a follow-up question is, who created the Palantir? Was it the Valar?
These are elvish tools, yeah. Or maybe they might have been gift from the Valar, actually. But they're
a little bit like the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil.
A little bit
like it's meant to just be there, but don't use it.
Yeah,
it's a sin to use it.
Did you think that, like, the thing that bothers me, and maybe this is just the text, the subtext of the book becoming text, but the way Galadriel talks to these people, it's just like, why aren't you on board with all of our shit? It reminds me a lot. Do you remember the movie Love Actually? When, like, Billy Bob Thornton is playing, like, a pastiche of George W. Bush, a swaggering American president that just treats Britain like they're the kid brother. And it's like, you're obviously going to go along with our trade deals and we're going to ram this through your throat. And if you don't accept it, we're going to, you know, like, it comes across a really high and mighty. Yeah. I felt like she's Billy Bobbing Muriel's Hugh Grant here. It's very disrespectful. It's like, why did you abandon our ways? And you know, that the Valar gifted this for virtue, and it's taken away if we turn from darkness. And then Galadriel says, "Your virtue was your loyalty to the elves." What the fuck?
Sounds pretty self-serving.
Yeah, man. Like, to the extent that you're on our side, I mean, this is the Axis and Evil all over again. You're either with us or against us. I thought, like,
yeah.
And the fact that Muriel wasn't even that pissed about it. She's just like, yeah, you're right, man. We've really gone away from the old elf ways. Like, it's kind of blew my mind.
I think they do a good
patronizing job. She's being.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they do a good job in this scene showing that Muriel is torn, though, right? Muriel is like, sure. I am the leader of these people, and I, to the extent of my ability, and where I think it lines up with their interests, I need to be on board with what they think.
Yes.
And they think that we should not return to these old ways, therefore I can't lead them down that path. My father tried it, and he got his ass kicked out, so it wouldn't even end well for me. I do have a little bit of faith. But my faith alone isn't going to be enough to do this. And more importantly, I shouldn't push these people toward my faith necessarily if that's not where they want to go.
Right. Like, if you are such a champion for change and progress that you get unelected, you know, like, what good are you actually doing? Like, there's your ideals, and there's what's possible, and there's what's pragmatic, and you should always try to get everything you can do. But like, at some point, if you push too hard, you're going to lose. But I just thought it's the way Galadriel's talking, you know, and again, it's a point that she is not a very good diplomat at this point. But I don't know why Muriel was accepting some of this like meekly. Although I did thought the line that she had where Galadriel's like, you know, just have faith in me and the elves. And she's like, faith might bind one heart, but it's too fine a thread to hang a kingdom.
Yeah.
I thought that's a great line. She's like, well, yeah, you've convinced me, but this retail diplomacy handshake stuff is not going to work for an entire nation. And I can't ask these people to. Now, the thing is, I think that's a smart sentiment. I don't know what happens. I don't know what happens by the end of the episode, except for the fact that the gods tears. But this is just another vision that only she herself saw.
I had a huge question about that at the end. Is this something that culturally, and I think they most of the way get there with her speech that she gives, like culturally, this is a significant moment for everyone, right? Not just for someone who's seen this vision. I think those falling petals, the tears of the Valar or whatever, it means something to everyone. And so that might change the minds of pretty much everyone who saw them, which should be almost everyone.
Yeah. You should see a lot of, that was a big public area. Yeah. The white trees. You might be right about that.
So I think they get most of the way there. I'm okay with it at least. But I think Farazan has a lot to, his role is a lot more complicated.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about that when we get there.
And it's going to be super interesting, I think, to see what happens to Numenor after Muriel leaves, because I have to imagine the person who gets put into power is the Chancellor.
Yeah.
So Farazan has some promises to live up to from the people who didn't want this to happen. So where does he go? Where does he lead the people?
I thought there's some clever, like, ultra diplomatic things are happening here where it seems like, you know, this is an all volunteer force and they're going to democratically vote, even though we got a queen regent, like the citizens, preponderance of citizens have to, like, but what is he going to do when she's off fighting the war?
Mm-hmm.
Will she come back to a kingdom that she recognizes, you know?
Yeah. Interesting.
There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
All right, let's move over to Rowan, Theo's friend, returning with food, but not with Theo, and Bronwyn is very worried. And then we go back over to Theo, who leaves the well that night and tries to sneak out of town, but he's grabbed by the orcs. Luckily, Arendir shows up just in time to save him. And then Arendir covers him as they run through the woods from the orcs, and Bronwyn catches up with them, and then they make it to the sun-filled clearing, which provides cover.
I wrote in my notes that Theo gets out of the well so he can play Splinter Cell Uncharted Zero Dawn.
Yep. I could not help but think.
Oh, tall my
grass,
God.
Especially the tall grass. It's literally hiding in the tall grass.
It's hiding the tufts of tall grass. It's the sneaking along the half walls with your back pressed to it. It's like literally a stealth mechanic video game.
Yep.
And I was thinking the whole time, I was like, dude, just stay in the well another hour. These orcs are about to pack out of here. Mm-hmm. But then we wouldn't get the sick ass scene with Arendir. And it is like, so I've criticized like Galadriel running up swords and some other things. Like I thought the chain was borderline goofy, but ultimately awesome. This is what I love about elves. The fact that like he's able to, with his back turned, hear this whistle, arrow whistling at them, push the kid down out of danger, again, without even looking, snatching the arrow out of the air and returning it to cinder in one smooth motion. That's the elf shit that I get off on. Legolas rapid firing arrows and then getting onto the horse by just grabbing the reins and like using his body motion, like the kung fu himself onto there. I love that stuff. And I love it. I love Arendir hitting all these fuckers dead center of mass, just like no expression, no emotion, just thunk every one of them. I thought this was a really cool action scene.
Absolutely. I thought it was amazing. You have to not think about, you know, the force that it must have taken to knock Theo to the ground in that fraction of a second. Shattering his spine and bones.
He'll never walk again, but he didn't take an orc arrow in the chest. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, if you forget about all that, yeah, it looks amazing. And it's super cool. I've been looking at their use of slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the horse thing might bother me less than the slow motion in this scene. And it's not necessarily when he catches the arrow, because I think that's worthy of slow motion.
Uh-huh.
It's the run to the clearing. Like when I think about the use of slow motion in Lord of the Rings, it's dropping the freaking ring in a Mount Doom, right? It's like climactic moments. Mm-hmm. It's climactic moments for characters. Is it Boromir's death? Is he the one who takes a bunch of arrows?
Oh, yeah.
And they do the slow motion thing and he's fighting off orcs and it's fucking awesome. And he's not going down without a fight. That's all slow motion. That's a climax for a character. This is just they make it to the field. I felt like the arrow catch warranted the slow motion. The rest of it did not. But that was me.
I did appreciate that. I thought they did a good job of showing, like, rooting this in a time and place, because, like, it did. You saw the dawn coming. Mm-hmm. And then because I was like, God, how are they going to get away? Like, these orcs are everywhere. They're gaining on them. And then when he's like, get to the clearing, you can kind of see the sun start to come up, and they just made it. That felt really satisfying.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't mind it. I thought it accentuated action. But to take I get your point. Like, these 70, 75 minute episodes where they're using a lot of these slow-mo and some of the stuff feels indulgent, and then yet they still can't be crystal clear with, like, what characters' motivations and objectives and, like, where places are, is a little frustrating, sure. But
yeah, sometimes
I do think that, again, these are very inexperienced showrunners. And I have a lot of faith that some of these creaky things that we're seeing in some of these episodes will probably be fixed as we continue going on. And I'll even allow that there are probably some leftover COVID bullshit. Like, there's clearly these things were shot a while back and they had to do a whole ton of post-processing and post-production on them. I really hope that they can tighten already a pretty well-running ship. I hope they can tighten up a little bit in season two.
Yeah. And I will say, I know there are other times in Lord of the Rings they use slow motion to less effect. You know, Legolas gets slow motion all the time, but he's doing cool shit. I'm okay with it if they're doing cool shit, but running from orcs is not necessarily cool shit. All right, let's go over to Disa doing some cool shit. She sings a song to help the miners get out alive. Turns out they do, which was pretty, like, just like, I'm singing this song, the miners will get out alive. The miners got out alive.
Mm-hmm. Didn't have to wait very long on that.
Right.
I thought it was dope how they blend the one scene into the other, because Disa's singing starts, like, this mournful starts up during Bronwyn and Arendir and the Theo's fleeing of the orcs. Mm-hmm. And then just seamlessly blends into her and her sister dwarf singing through the mountain here.
Yeah, and it's hoping, you know, these people will get out alive. It equally applies to them.
And I just got to say, this thing just sounded so fucking good on my setup and in the acoustics of my living room. It was an experience.
Nice. Despite all the miners getting out alive, the king is shutting down the old mine. Durin is furious and wants to curse his father, but Elrond tells Durin how awesome his father was and how Durin is lucky to have a father at all. And then they joke about how they met.
Normally, I hate this kind of stuff. I hate when someone comes up to a person who's have a difficult relationship with their parents and is like, well, you know, at least you got a mom or dad, and I'd give anything. It's like, well, shut the fuck up. I'm glad you loved your dad. You know, I'm glad you loved your mom. You don't know what my relationship was like. But to me, this was a friend trying to help, like, maybe a hot-headed friend over an initial kind of, like, disappointment. And you can see that he was also following Disa's suit. Like, Disa wasn't like, yeah, you're right, your old man's a bastard. He's never believed in it. She's like, you know, even the hottest coal can cool down. And Durin's kind of just being a dick. You know, he's reacting to, I think, his father's rat. Like, you just almost killed four of our dwarves down there, man. This is some, let's slow down, not dig too deep or too greedily. We don't want any Balrog situations.
I mean, it's so him just backing, knowing what comes, but
I think it's him backing his friend in a true place, not like dismissing the fact that Durin has a real problem with his dad, but like Durin is a little bit of a hothead, you know, stubborn person who doesn't have the authority of the king to make these decisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, using his experience with his father and being, you know, wondering if he's going to live up to him and his fucking star dad and his expectations. I thought it was pretty good. And it was a nice emotional resonance of these friends. And I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah. And it rolls into the next scene pretty well.
Oh, before we move in, though, I really appreciate, you know, because, again, one of the criticisms we have of House of Dragons is not much humor. I actually really liked Elrond and him going back and forth on the, well, because you think Elrond's going to super back him, like, oh, I got to correct the detail. There's actually three cave trolls or whatever it was. But then he immediately starts, I just heard this shrieking and it was so high pitched, I assumed it had to be a small child. And Durin's like, it was my war cry. And this, I thought, it's just their odd couple routine is really endearing and funny.
It is, yeah. Whenever they get those two good friends together, kind of going at each other playfully, like, it works with Poppy and Nori as well.
It does. It's a good time. They've got some of those solid relationships that can go back and forth, and it's just a pleasure to watch. Only four episodes in.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the aftermath of this, where Durin goes to apologize to his father, but his father is very quick to forgive. Actually, says there's nothing to forgive. And they both think that there's something else going on with Elrond's appearance. So Durin decides to go to Lindon to find out what it is.
Yeah, I don't know what the secret part is. Is it the forge or the... Because I don't even think they've said what Celebrimbor is building. He's just alluding to he wants to have something for real power. So it seems like there's an opportunity for the elves to horn in on the dwarves. Brand new era for their race, and for the dwarves to horn in on the elves, new era for their powerful artifact, whatever they're making.
Yeah.
But it's also like if that implies that Elrond's deliberately keeping a nature of the project secret. And I don't like how he's a hypocrite when he goes, secrets do not become friendships such as ours. That's a great, powerful sentiment. But also, it seems like you're keeping secrets, man.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's boy, I don't know how to get around the idea that he is being deceitful here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes all the, you know, friendly stuff he's doing feel wrong.
It feels like these elves are just really patronizing to the quote unquote lesser races, which is like your first clue that they're maybe patronizing, you know.
Sure. But no, I think like Peter Mullen is really great in this scene.
Oh, so good.
I really like his Durin. Daddy Durin.
Daddy Durin.
Because they're both named Durin. Yeah.
I've never seen Peter Mullen be a good guy.
Sure.
And he's like just really warm and that, you know, has his king. Because I feel like that the old Durin, Daddy Durin, was like maybe on the verge of apologizing too. Because you kind of see him kind of close his eyes and relax as Durin starts up the forgive me, father business. And this is another great line of dialogue. It's like, you know, they say that when the dwarven kings, be crowned, they have the wisdom of their forefathers and all their advice and their words of encouragement and their mistakes flood into you. And he's like, but you won't have to wait to hear my words. I'm with you always, son. Like, that's powerful stuff.
For sure. All right, let's go back over to the Elven Tower where Bronwyn, well, one of the Elven Towers, the former Elven Tower. How about that? The Guard Tower. Bronwyn thanks Arendir for helping her son, and he delivers Adar's message that they may live if they forsake their lands and swear fealty to Adar. Otherwise, he's coming for you. Aes Tirith?
Yep, Aes Tirith.
Yeah, not much to the scene. I mean, she's happy to have him back, but also they still don't confess their love for each other, right?
No.
I'm kind of surprised by that. I expected them to have a moment here and actually say it, but...
Oh, man, now that there's actually a crisis on, the elf is going to really... I can't. That's not the right time. It's not the right time to hit on her now. Her son just found a Morgul blade. Like, what? Come on.
Yeah, I expect her to be dying before he actually says it. Mm. We'll see. Theo's playing with the sword, and the innkeeper, Waldron, sees it and tells him that it has enormous power and asks him if he's heard the good word of Sauron. Theo tells him, I don't know, Theo doesn't seem on board with the message of Sauron, but Waldron says, be ready, because we're going to have to when Sauron returns.
And will he get a choice? Because, like, you know, Frodo slips the ring on the finger and it starts affecting him immediately. And again, that turns out to be the one ring. But this is some bad shit. I thought it's interesting how the old man has a scar on his forearm exactly like, yeah, like he's been he's plugged into that blade more than once. And he's clearly like ground central for evil men in the village. You know, he's secretly been loyal to Sauron this whole time, running his cult of Sauron. And I feel like I thought Theo was listening a lot. You know, he's not completely down with it. But number one, what choice is he going to have if this thing starts taking him over? And two, you know, this guy's talking about like, hey, we could have real power. we used to be these glorious people, and something was taken from us. We were robbed of our heritage, and this blade is doesn't try to take the blade back. That's the other thing I thought. And the fact that Theo keeps like getting this blade out and like admiring it and fondling it, you know, like every chance he gets, like, you know, he's getting in and it's even less and less private. It's like it feels like it's already becoming an obsession with him.
Totally. And I look at the age he is and I look at how his mother in his eyes is holding him back. Right. And the tighter her grip, you know, it's the Star Wars thing.
Sure.
He's going to slip right through her fingers and probably into Sauron's hands if she's not careful.
You can't resist evil artifacts. Like that was Frodo and Sam's whole arc. Mm-hmm. But boy, it seems like it's hard for the hearts of men to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm just worried that Bronwyn's actions are pushing him more toward that, not less.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. And that happens to a lot of parents, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. Finally, Galadriel is sent away on a very small boat, and the queen goes to announce her departure to the people. However, on her way to the plaza, the flower petals from the vision fall, and she changes her mind, tells her people instead that she is going to the Southlands with an army to fight with the humans. Not to fight with the humans, to fight with the elves. With the humans? I don't know. They're all kind of together.
Sure.
Isildur, his friends, and seemingly half at least the other Numenoreans all volunteer to go.
Yeah, and this reminds me a lot of like King Leonidas in 300, the fact that like he was forbidden officially from going to war, but no one can stop me from taking my bodyguard out for a hike. And she's like, I'm going to personally escort our prisoner to Middle Earth. And I would like, and that's when they're recruiting, they're like, who is going to volunteer for the Queen's Guard?
Right.
And it seems like it's all very democratic, that the nobles are all there in the house of the Numenorean representatives, and they're raising their hand that they're going to support this military action, and they're only taking volunteers. What really confused me is why Arian and Elendil looks so shocked/angry at Isildur volunteering, because I thought they were pro elf and that they would be in support of him. I don't understand how they're acting.
Does Elendil know yet that he's been kicked out of the Sea Guard?
Probably not. Him. Yeah, because I don't think there's been, you know, like his sister didn't. She surmised it by his clothing.
Mm-hmm. So he could be shocked just at the fact that he would give up the Sea Guard after I forbid him from, you know, going on crazy journeys.
But this is like, even if that was the case, like, this seems like a spectacular circumstance, like the return of an elf and your queen. Like essentially all patriotic men of goodwill, pleased to me.
Totally.
And like Elendil's reaction was overwhelmingly one of anger, I thought. And I just like, I just don't understand. Again, don't understand what going west means in this context. I don't understand why Elendil would be pissed that he's escorting his queen and serving Lady Galadriel. Like I said, I lost the plot a little bit here. And I think it's because it's just unclear. Yeah. Also, really enjoyed Galadriel just firing a 10 megawatt stink eye laser at everyone in this final scene. Like even Elendil like goes up there and speaks elf to her, says go in peace, and she's like whatever, fuck out of my way. Like and then drives her rowing her away, she turns the battery one more time on Muriel and just gives the full broadsides of stink eye. It's just incredible the way she does diplomacy.
I don't know how much foreknowledge you have here, but do you think Elendil is going with the queen, or is he staying back in Numenor?
I have no idea. I'm guessing as a newly minted post captain, whatever the hell that means in Numenor society, that he is going to go, and that this is going to give him and Isildur a good long chance to talk about the shit going on west and Anarion and why he's a black sheep and maybe he's right. I hope so, because, man, I really need to get some answers, because I still am completely uninvested in Elendil and Isildur.
Gotcha. The other thing about this is we kind of know this fight is doomed, right? If you've seen Lord of the Rings, the bad shit is going to happen. There's nothing they can do to prevent that.
Yeah. That's a
there's
prequel,
going to
be
a giant war. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of bad stuff. So I don't want to say too much about it, because maybe some people haven't seen it, but
But yeah, it's like you can watch the prologue for Lord of the Rings for massive spoilers about like where this is probably going to go and end. But I think it's going to be like this. Everything I say about Fire and Blood, you know, the House of the Dragon show, where that's like just such a history book, such a dry account. And it's the motivations and the personal relationships and fleshing those out that really makes the thing sing. Like that goes double for the appendix of Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
You know, this is very, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then they sailed over, and then this happened. You know, again, I don't even mind that they swerve like from the canon a little bit. It's just, I feel like they're definitely swerving, and I'm not sure what they're swerving to. So like, I'm just really hesitant to say one way or another. And I do think they're being a little bit unclear. I got that from talking to John this morning too.
Yeah.
The fact that he's not exactly sure what they're talking, you know, a guy is steeped in Tolkien lore. It's like, what do they mean by going to the West? They keep on calling it the West. The West means something, you know, in the Tolkienology. So we'll see. We got four more episodes for things to come into focus. So we'll see if they get it done.
Yeah, and I don't think they're telling those personal stories perfectly.
No.
I think they're doing a good enough job. I'm getting on board with those stories.
And they're crushing the Harfoots. They're crushing the dwarves and the elves.
Yep.
They're just having a real tough time with the elves and humans. Although I think they're doing a pretty good job at the southern stuff, the Southron stuff.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's just, you know, standing up next to House of the Dragon, which is kind of all about that in these first five episodes.
Yeah,
I'm like, it's not quite up to that par, but
yeah,
you know,
but the visuals in House of Dragon aren't up to the Lord of the Rings Rings of Power standards either.
Fair. Yeah, that's it for the episode. I'm really curious to see where this takes Numenor, with the person who I assume is going to be ruling Farazan having obligations to people and obligations to the people specifically who aren't going to go on this journey, because they're not interested in helping the elves. So.
If you've got some things to say, which I'm sure you do, don't forget we'll have a feedback episode out next week. dug2deep@baldmove.com is how you send in feedback to that. Also, the Lorehounds will be out. A Lorehound will be out with a Baldhound. John and Jim, the two J's, are joining forces to do a lore deep dive, which I can't wait to hear what this sounds like.
Dude, you want to check this podcast out just for the stunt factor, because I have no idea either.
Yeah. But yeah, we'll see. Going to Jim naked and afraid, wading into the deep end of Tolkien lore with a truly cracked out lore hound.
He's a dive master. So I feel safe in the deep end, but man, it's true.
You got to trust he's going to have your scuba tank set up right and your parachute packed correctly. It's going to get weird scuba parachuting, but. dug2deep@baldmove.com. The Lorehounds Monday, our feedback podcast I think comes out Wednesday, and then we'll do it all again next Friday. Thanks for following along. If you'd like to follow us along on all of our projects, twitter.com/baldmove is the best way to do that. You can also discuss the Rings of Power with all of our fellow fans at our Discord. Also, the Lorehounds have their own special section where you can go crazy with the lore on our Discord, discord.baldmove.com. Again, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week for an expanded lore podcast. And you also make sure that you subscribe to the Lorehounds feed for that, because their lore cast only comes out on the Lorehounds feed. You can find that by, I think, searching for Second Age or just the Lorehounds on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you Monday. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.